My name is Richard Haynes. I've been a research scientist since the mid-1960s, working in the field of aeronautics and aerophysics, I should say aerospace physiology, and vision and optics, perception, lighting, photometry. I've worked on the Gemini program for the space program, worked on the Apollo program, the Skylab program, on several aeronautical programs, and I retired from federal service in 1988, and since then I have taught at a local university. And from a science point of view, I can't ignore the data. The phenomena is just so beautiful, so powerful, so curious, that it demands some scientific involvement. And I feel that the pilot sightings are very valuable because of a number of factors. The pilots are highly educated and trained for the first point. And what that means is that they have a career at stake. And they're not going to come forward with a report of some strange object or light off the side of the aircraft or near the aircraft unless they've already eliminated all of the prosaic explanations. They're just risking their career to do so. And so that's the first reason I like pilot cases. Another reason is that they're flying aircraft that are just packed with electromagnetic sensors on board of all kinds, you see, or equipment that may be influenced by EM radiation. And so if we can find some characteristic change in those instruments, or the radio, or radar, or the direction finder, or VORs, or DMEs, or various kinds of onboard cockpit instruments, we're learning something about the nature of the radiation that's, we think, related to the phenomena in some way. And of course, that's what science is about then. Science can get interested in the phenomenon if it has some good firm data to work with. In some cases, jet interceptors, Air Force interceptors have been set up, many cases actually, to help or to identify or investigate the phenomenon. But the pilot might ask for radar coverage. Did you see anything on radar? And Captain Daniels' story includes that very event. Did you see anything on radar? And Boston Air Traffic Control said, no, we don't see anything. But sometimes they do. I have many, many cases in my AirCat files where there is good positive visual radar correspondence. Well, I'm asked quite often to say something about AirCat. These initials stand for Air Catalog. This is a rather extensive library I've been collecting for almost 30 years now from commercial, military, private, and test pilots. I have over 3,000 cases now. A certain proportion are certainly historical that I've not interviewed myself because in some of them they're so old I wasn't even alive. I wasn't born yet. And many of them come from Project Blue Book, which is the official Air Force study of the subject. But many of the more recent ones I have investigated and have tape recordings or video recordings of the interviews with the pilots. I have FAA tapes that you can obtain as a citizen through Freedom of Information Act requests. And so this database is very large. It's and those cases that are not complete are usually the result of a hesitancy on the part of the pilot to disclose everything. If they're a commercial pilot, for instance, there may be concerns about job security or ridicule, some reasonable, I shouldn't say reasonable, but understandable reasons why they won't report. In half of the cases at least, the phenomenon appears to approach the airplane. not the other way around. It's as if the aircraft is the focus of attention or curiosity, if I may use that word, of the phenomena. That the pilot's flying along minding his own business, and something comes up alongside one wing for 15 minutes at cruise altitude, cruise speed, and then sometimes will flip over to the other wing or stay right at the nose of the aircraft and then do barrel rolls along the flight axis. Some very interesting maneuvers. The kind of flight maneuvers that our aircraft are generally not capable of doing. Here's an interesting case involving magnetic compass deviation. It took place on May 26, 1979, at about midnight, over south central Utah. And this is a private aircraft. James Gallagher had left Blackfoot, Idaho, before midnight, and it was now at 10,000 feet altitude in his light aircraft. And he was just south of the Challis National Forest, intent upon landing at Friedman Memorial Airport at Haley in Idaho, about 14 miles south of Sun Valley. In his own words, quote, "I looked up in front of me and saw these five orange objects in a horizontal formation in front of me, and then they tilted like an aircraft would dip its wings, and I thought it was lights on an aircraft of some kind. Then they spread out, and I knew damn well it wasn't an aircraft," unquote. At one point, the object regrouped and formed a vertical line. Then they moved around randomly, apparently coming closer to me. Then all five came to the left side of my aircraft. Quote, "My magnetic compass started spinning, and my automatic direction finder started spinning. At that point, they were in a straight line formation, and then they just blinked out. I did have trouble receiving on the radio because of heavy static, and my engine started running rough." Unquote. It's also of interest to note that a Braniff flight crew also reported seeing orange objects below their altitude the same morning while flying at 35,000 feet altitude, only 120 miles south of Gallagher's sighting, and again at 2:53 after midnight a.m. when they were some 70 miles northwest of Ogden, Utah. Ground radar also tracked the objects during this encounter. So there we have an interesting case of several aircraft, compasses deviating, radio frequency interference, and radar. There's a wealth of data there. And it just amazes me that my colleagues in the physical sciences just, for some reason, aren't interested in this subject. Recently, I went through all of my thousands of pilot reports, and I was looking in that review just for American aircraft, registered aircraft. And within that subset, not foreign, but American, what number of reports could I find that seemed to impact aviation safety? I found 100 cases that I felt had some important impact where flight safety was impaired or reduced in some way. Now, in the process of doing that, I had to read all the foreign cases as well. And I was blown away by the similarity of close encounters of American and foreign aircraft, flight crews, let's say. It suggests that the phenomenon is worldwide, obviously. We take that for granted now. It's not showing up differently by culture, for instance. That the behavior of the phenomenon near an aircraft is the same for foreign aircraft as it is American aircraft, as I would expect. So we start raising questions about intelligence. Is there some intelligent guidance behind the phenomenon? Well, that's a scientific question. That's a valuable scientific question. And to me, where I am right now in the data analysis, I think there is. I'm gaining more and more data to make this case that there is a high degree of intelligence and control behind this phenomenon. But when I look historically back at the data from 50 years ago, Well, I know something about aerospace technology from the space program, at least. I don't know about the military work, because that's been highly classified. But from the last 50 years or so of automation, I could say that at least in the non-black programs, we could not do what these objects were reported as doing. And so that says that if it's intelligent, it's probably not human intelligence. To me, intelligence is generally shown by non-random kinds of events, regular events, for instance. And my book called Project Delta is an analysis of multiple objects seen either from the ground or the air. There are many pilot cases there. But when I look carefully at the flight dynamics, the flight formations that multiple objects seem to display next to a pilot, I have to say that they are precisely guided, that they know where they are in three-dimensional space at any moment. They know where their neighbors are in three-dimensional space. They seem to be able to communicate so that they all execute maneuvers simultaneously, not like the Navy Blue Angels that take a little, a fraction of a second before the reaction time sets in. They would like to be simultaneous, but they're really not. There's a time lag there. But another illustration of intelligence, and this can be disputed, this can be debated, I understand. I had a B-52 captain tell me once that he was flying in the front left seat of a brand new B-52 from Wichita, Kansas, where it was made by the Boeing Corporation, and his job was to ferry that aircraft with a light crew, not a full crew, to an Air Force base in the southwestern part of America. Clear, sunny day, beautiful, bright sky, and an object, a round sphere, probably 4 or 5 feet in diameter, with no markings, no rivets, no seams, no insignias, no USAF on the side, showed up right off his left wingtip. Well, his co-pilot said, "Captain, we have an object off our right wingtip," and he described it, and it was the same shape, size, and every identical to this one on the left wing. So there's two objects now, keeping up with the aircraft at cruise altitude and cruise speed. Well, to make a long story short, he told me that an object showed up behind the aircraft, above the aircraft, below the aircraft, and off each wingtip, five total. And I said, "Well, what did you do?" He said, "Well, I hit the autopilot button on the control column and went into evasive maneuvers," which is kind of standard operating procedure, "to try to shake these things." And he said, "I tried to... if they were balloons, they weren't going to keep up with us very long. If they were birds, why were they at that altitude and flying at 300 or 400 miles an hour?" So forth and so on. Good, typical piloting behavior. Checking off what they weren't, you see. Well, he said, no matter what I did with that aircraft, they stayed with the aircraft perfectly aligned. It was called station keeping. So he said, after a while of this, we're running out of fuel and I have a job to do. He said he added power, got back up to cruise altitude, and put it on back on autopilot. And he said after 15 or so minutes more, the objects departed from the aircraft in the exact opposite order they arrived. Intelligence. To me, that's not random. That's intelligence. That's deliberate. I can say happily that we don't know of any major cases where deaths have occurred from UAP. I think the reason for that's very interesting, that there have not been any collisions that we know of with commercial flights from UAP. Why? Because the phenomenon seems to get out of the way in time. Highly maneuverable. Great deal of energy to deal with. And flying an airplane is fundamentally manipulating energy from one form to another. Thrust vectoring is another way of thinking about that. Well, now think about that for a moment, that if this phenomenon is so maneuverable that it can avoid a collision at the last minute, and this technical report has scores of cases like that, zipping over the top of the aircraft just at the last moment. Pilot doesn't do anything. That says something about intelligence, doesn't it? It suggests technology, at least. It suggests an understanding of energy management that I don't think we have. Now, some skeptics will say that these are all visual illusions. And I can't buy that. Not all these cases. Not with three sets of eyeballs in that cockpit. Not with radar confirmation. Not with ground confirmation by radar. Or even additional aircraft nearby. I think it's fair to say that pilots, being human beings, are subject to the same pressures, psychological pressures, as anyone is in our culture, against reporting these strange experiences, these strange phenomena that shouldn't exist. The authorities tell us there's no threat. They tell us that there's nothing to worry about, that there's really nothing there. So why report something that's not really there? You see? So pilots, being professionals, have careers at stake. And so it's easier not to report them. So they don't report them. Now, we don't know how many are not reported. All we know is the number that are reported, obviously. But my estimate is that for every one pilot who does come forward and makes a confidential or a public report, I would estimate there's 20, 30 other pilots who don't. As a result of this review of my AirCat files, I found a number of cases back in the 60s, for instance, when the Air Force was still heavily involved in this subject, where they stepped in and interviewed, let's use the word, commercial pilots, not just their own military pilots, but commercial pilots, and ended the interview by saying, "You're not to tell anybody about what you saw." Captain Kenju Terauchi was piloting a Boeing 747, Japan Airlines, from Paris, France to Tokyo over the polar route. And I interviewed him by phone. I'm the only civilian to interview this gentleman, after he and his crew had a major sighting over northern Alaska on their way to Anchorage to land for refueling. And as a result of his following the rules, which he did, making a report out, landing safely, delivering the cargo, being a good pilot, Japan Airlines asked him to not fly anymore. And I happened to meet the chief medical officer for Japan Airlines on that incident, and I asked him why. Why did you relieve Captain Terauchi from his flying duties? Flying a desk, right? And his answer was, "Well, we convened a medical review board on this incident, and we decided that it was not wise for Japan Airlines to have a pilot flying who sees such strange things." And that was the answer given. So Captain Terauchi was then not demoted, I guess you'd say, but at least in that culture, that's hard on the ego and on self-image, on pride, very hard. And so I have to tell you the end of the story, and it was that I may have said too much to this Japanese gentleman in a three-piece suit in Japan Airlines, but I said, "Well, I have to disagree with you, sir. I think you have a fine pilot there. Captain Terauchi is a very fine pilot. He did follow the instructions. He did report accurately. He did maintain control of that aircraft at all times. He did deliver his cargo. And he was not the only pilot that I know of that has seen such strange things as that. Very large objects, for instance. This was a huge object near his aircraft." And he said, "Well, that's very interesting. Would you like to submit any information in his behalf?" And I said, "I'd be delighted." So I came home and put together a packet about 2 inches thick where I said all this in writing and appended examples from my files of similar cases to show that Captain Terauchi was not the only person who's ever had an experience like this. And I sent it off to Tokyo. Never heard another thing for about, I don't know, maybe 6-8 months, a year, maybe even a year, I don't remember now. And I learned later that he was reinstated to flying status. So he's now flying again, happy to say.
Good.
When we look at daylight sightings of UFO phenomena in general, there is probably more commonality than difference. I'll have to say that. For instance, the great majority of the phenomena reflect ambient light. What that means is it's like a bumper of a car that's polished chrome and it reflects sunlight. And you see a little image of the sun. Well, that's the kind of surface characteristics that the objects almost always have. Not always, but usually. Another classification of surface characteristics is pitch black, almost a black hole where it's absorbing light. For instance, during the daytime, the great majority of these objects seem to reflect light just like a solid surface would, just like a chrome bumper of a car would reflect sunlight, for instance. However, very seldom do we see seams, markings, rivets, any sort of insignias. There's almost none. That these are just smooth, aeronautically shaped. Very seldom do we find sharp edges. They're usually smooth, rounded edges. Quite often there's a little protrusion either on the top or the bottom, or both, that some people describe as a cupola or a cockpit of some sort. And very often they're transparent, and detail can be seen inside the windows. Very interesting. And for a pilot to look you in the eye and tell you that, you know, at 100 yards distance, at altitude, that has a great emotional impact on me, I must say. I have a number of cases where the object, or whatever it is, let's call it an object, does not reflect light, but it's pitch black. That it's like a black hole. It almost absorbs light. Typically, they have sharp edges. They're not fuzzy edges, which suggests a physical object there as opposed to an atmospheric, an optical phenomena. And one case in particular comes to mind. And this is a Canadian pilot flying by himself in a two-engine propeller cargo aircraft, a DC-3. And he's flying about sundown to the south after having dropped off an oil crew at a little dirt strip north of in Canada. Saskatchewan, I think it was. And he's flying about 5,000 feet altitude, about ready to land. And his wife is down there, has a coffee on, and the radio on. And he radios to her that, hey, honey, I'm going to be home in 20 minutes, get the coffee going, and I'm hungry. And he said to me that off to the western horizon, the sun is about on the horizon, ready to go down, he noticed a black speck. And at that great distance off to his right, he thought it was another aircraft. So he kept an eye on it. He just keeps on going straight ahead, obviously. He said this object, whatever it was at his altitude and moving rather quickly from right to left until it was pretty much right ahead of him. And then he said it stopped. It came to an abrupt halt right in front of his aircraft, and he started to gain, the distance was lessening, and it got bigger and bigger and bigger. I said, well, what did it look like? He said it looked like a bullet. It was flat on its rear end, pointed on its front, and kind of parallel at the top, and then it tapered down to the point on the front. Well, what did you do? He said, nothing I could do. It was just there in front of me, and then it maintained distance. It just kept a constant distance. It didn't change in size, in other words. So we're equating size of the object with separation distance. And what happened, I said? Well, after some minutes, it just continued on its way in its original direction. End of story? Almost. He radioed his wife to describe what had happened. Found out that he'd lost some time. Some time had passed, longer than should have normally from where he was to where he should be going to land the aircraft. And I suspect when the object was right ahead, that's when the missing time occurred. There are very often multicolored lights on these objects, daytime and night. Well, why do you need lights on in the daytime? You see, it has a collision avoidance, perhaps, not with a reflecting surface. The lights are not FAA approved. Very often they're blue lights, and that's not an approved aircraft color, you see. So something else is going on here. The lights are often sequenced on and off in some regular pattern. They would be rotating clockwise around the circumference, for instance. Aircraft don't have that.